supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a very important question of the week for parents coming up later in the show. Maybe you try to keep a toxic-free home. Maybe you have an organic lawn and garden, and then you find out your kids are being exposed to pesticides at school. What can you do? We'll tell you about a great resource you can turn to. But mostly, we're taking your fabulous phone calls today at 1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
It's good to be here, Mr. Mike. How are you?
I am just fine, sir. Thank you very much. And where are you?
I'm in Stella, North Carolina.
And you're so tired of hearing people do the bad Broadway imitation, right?
Stella!
Yeah. I could have been somebody. Yeah. So what can we do for you, David?
Well, I had a question about Epsom salt, and I went ahead and applied it unadvised. I did some internet research, and you know everything's true on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
My raised beds were kind of having some difficulty, and I didn't want to go with the chemical. So I heard my buddy actually started a garden his first year, and I didn't expect much from it. And I went by there the other day, and it was beautiful, green, and everything was producing, and the flowers smelled good, and so I applied some Epsom salt on half of my garden, and my peppers smiled at me. It worked wonderful. I mean, my question is, how much do you put in? I don't know.
Well, I have never heard of anyone using Epsom salts on an entire garden. Epsom salts are technically a chemical, so I'm not going to use it, but they're absolutely harmless. I don't have any problem with people using Epsom salts. But typically in the past, and this has been old gardening lore going back for 50 years, what people would do would be to put a teaspoon to a tablespoon's worth either around established flowering plants like roses or in the planting hole when they put in peppers, tomatoes, or cucumbers.
Right.
So they could get the little bit of phosphorus out of the Epsom salts that would be a bloom booster. But as with any granular substance, whether it's a chemical fertilizer, Epsom salts, bone meal, a natural organic fertilizer, they work best when they're actually covered with soil. Laying on the surface of the soil, you're going to get the least effect because it's a mineral, and it takes a while to become absorbed by the soil and turned into a form that plants can utilize efficiently. So,
yeah, well, I put it at a tablespoon and gallon, mixed it up real good, and applied it.
Oh, okay.
So that would be a no-no for the true organic gardener, is the Epsom salt.
It's not like you're spraying Roundup or using Miracle-Gro or Osmocote. This is something that does go back years. Now, did you say you had a raised bed garden?
I do. Right. I have like 6 or 7 4x8 raised beds, 4x8, and then I have one at 6x100 that I try. So,
wow, that's a railroad car.
And I try, every year I grind up leaves and I put all my, all the coffee grounds and the eggshells. I put it all in there and till it up every year. I left for a short time.
Ah, okay.
This trip and my neighbor put lime in, and so I'm trying to bounce back from his liming.
Okay, so he limed your garden and it killed everything.
It's not doing as well as it normally does.
Right. So people don't understand that lime is not a nutrient. Lime is just used to raise pH.
Yeah.
Here in the Northeast especially, we tend to have slightly acidic soils, so a lot of people will add lime or wood ash to their gardens, more generally their lawns. But if you add lime or wood ash to a garden whose soil is already pH neutral, you turn it into a killing field.
Yeah, it's not doing well. I didn't say anything to him, but the proof is in the cucumbers. It's just not it's not doing as well as it has been in the past. So.
If you want, it's not too late in the season. You can counteract that with a little bit of sulfur or some milled peat moss. That'll bring the pH back to neutral. But I would also urge you, you say you're putting your leaves and everything on your garden beds and tilling it all in?
I do that in the fall. Yeah, I mean, well, in the winter, and then I till it all in and, you know, just kind of let it hang out there until I plant.
Well, that's a great way to encourage a lot of weeds. And to lose soil nutrients. I think you're going to have a much better year next year if instead of doing that, you shred your leaves, make a big pile, mix in your coffee grounds and your eggshells if you choose, wait till you're ready to plant, because with your weather, compost happens very quickly, especially if you, if you shred the leaves and add the coffee grounds. And then no more tilling, because tilling is losing nutrients and bringing weed seeds to the surface. So when that stuff is nice and finished, or even if it's not finished, spread it directly on top of the beds. No more tilling. Because when you till, you release a lot of nutrients that are in the soil. They go back into the atmosphere. And as you know, you battle weeds all summer. And your summer summer is long and hot. From now on, work the no-till system. Just apply the compost to the surface. Just put it down as a mulch and, you know, put the plants in the ground around the mulch. You will see much better results.
All right.
You stay cool.
All right, now.
1-888-346-9499. Peter, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Peter. Where are you, sir?
I'm located in Doylestown, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia. Very good. What can we do you for?
I planted a Japanese maple for my wife on a Mother's Day about 3 years ago. And this past winter, we got so many trees on our property, a lot of branches came down. One of them landed right on the top of the maple. And it kind of crushed everything. You know, basically, the only thing that was left, I'm going to say, is about maybe a foot and a half of trunk at the bottom of it. And
right.
The trunk was actually split in half. So I didn't do anything with it. In the spring, the smaller branch or the smaller piece of the trunk that remained bloomed. We got shoots coming off of it. And I'm going to say it's only about maybe an inch and a half wide by maybe a half inch thick.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, pretty sliver of trunk. I guess it's getting fed from below, but it's still alive. The other side might be an inch and a half wide, completely cut off, but we're seeing this like a bushy kind of sprouts coming out of that. So I guess the question I've had is there anything I can do to help this tree, you know, get back to good condition? And, you know, what can I do to grow this tree back again?
You know, what you're describing to me is a tree that's had the top and one side removed and just as like a little stumpy thing in the ground, yeah, sending out some random shoots. Do you like the way it looks now?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Maybe there's some way I can craft, you know, kind of wrap the trunk together and maybe they would heal. I don't know. I don't know if that actually works or not.
It can work with big trees to keep them alive for a couple more years, big historic trees or giant trees that, you know, have separated out because a squirrel nibbled on them when they were a year old and they formed two trunks. Sometimes that can work. But no, your tree is dead, but your tree is in as much denial as you are.
Okay.
Matt Hudecki, he's our hired man. He's been helping me with my garden this year. We cut a big willow down, a pussy willow that had been in the middle of my garden that I cut down myself every 5-10 years. And the same thing happened as always happened. We took a whole bunch of new cuttings and we put those in really nice soil-free mix and watered them. And they all dried up and died. Then we threw the big trunk down in the gully. And I looked at the trunk the other day and there's all these big green sprouts coming out of it.
Okay.
So the plant still has some inherent energy left. If it didn't have to please someone with a look, it would just grow into a ratty-looking kind of Charlie Brown Japanese maple tree somewhere in the woods. But for the half the price of having somebody come in to suggest how they're going to duct tape and cable it together, you dig it up and you put a new one in the ground. The important thing is nothing bad happened to it that you caused. It didn't die because you used persistent herbicides on the lawn. Hopefully you didn't mulch, wood mulch all up against the trunk and rot it out.
I didn't.
You didn't prune it at the wrong time of year. A tree fell on it. You are not at fault, but you don't want to look at that sad thing much longer. What I would suggest is, because now we're getting into the summer season, is dig it up, or start to dig it up, get it out of there, make sure you remove the whole thing, and watch for when the nurseries have their fall sales. Sometime in September, they'll start wanting to get rid of these trees, and you'll be able to pick a really nice specimen of a Japanese maple that will probably be bigger than the one you lost, and you'll probably get it for half the price that you paid for the first one.
So the best time is to plant it in the fall? And
absolutely.
For
every reason. The plants are less expensive. The stress on them is much less. The survival rate is much higher. Fall is the best time for planting. Spring is the second best. It makes more sense to put a plant in the ground in the dead of winter than it does at the height of summer. The heat stress is just too much for a transplanted plant.
Right. Terrific. Thanks for your help. Appreciate
it. All right,
it.
Peter. Thank you. Take
right.
care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be doing a very special meet and greet and answering your garden questions live and in person on Saturday, August 2nd, beginning around 4 p.m. as part of the 10th annual Iron Hill Twilight Bike Race and Street Festival in downtown Westchester, PA. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and a great resource for parents who want their school districts to get more organic. I'm Organic Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we are going to reveal a great resource for parents who have children in a school district that is still using herbicides and other pesticides around their kids. This is exactly what you need to get that school district to come clean. But now we have a very special phone call, an update from an old friend of ours, Dr. Meg McGrath, about a serious problem that is affecting American gardens right now. First, it was tomato blight. Then it was a disease that knocked out everybody's impatience in their shade garden. And now it's basil downy mildew, I believe. Dr. Meg McGrath, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
Well, it's never a pleasure, Meg. You're just nothing but bad news. You never come on with happy talk. It's always some dread disease that's wiping out an entire group of plants somewhere.
Well, you need to invite me on to discuss something exciting someday.
No, you have been a great resource when the tomato blight first became apparent. You were right there for us. I should mention you're a plant pathologist from Cornell, and you seem to be right on top of tracking these outbreaks. I think you were the one who warned me that impatiens were going down last year, the year before, and mentioned something about basil. And this year, the basil problem is out of control, I understand.
Well, it seems to be. I see it in my garden. I've seen it in my garden every year since 2008, but I usually don't see it until July or August.
And it is a downy mildew, a member of the downy mildew, would you call it race of diseases?
A group of pathogens, and they are cousins to late blight.
Really? Late blight and downy mildew are related?
Yes, we call them oomycetes.
And explain why.
They're just biologically, they're related pathogens. So that also means that they've got some similarities. They produce spores that are getting dispersed by the air. They can infect under high humidity. They don't need leaves to be wet. And I think that's one of the issues. These pathogens, particularly the downy mildews, can develop in a greenhouse. And this is also a pathogen that can be in seed, and that's probably what's happened this year.
In seed?
Yes.
Oh, man. So
that's how it starts.
Obviously, it's real easy to save seed from basil because this is a plant that can't wait to go to seed in the garden, traditionally.
Very true.
And if you were a seed farm and you're collecting seed from this year's basil plants that you're going to sell the following year, is it possible that the plants would not have shown any sign of disease, but it could have been in the seed?
I think more likely what happens is the pathogen gets in the seed because the crop is affected.
Right. Then I'm going to guess that these weren't seeds that were made available to home gardeners.
Probably not, but that is a possibility.
Because
it's kind of new in this disease. Remember, this is a fairly new disease.
Right. And I got an email from you a couple of days ago where you said you had actually been in one of these big box stores and saw diseased plants for sale.
That's correct.
Now, what does a diseased basil plant look like, or at least one that has basil downy mildew?
The very first symptoms are going to be this sooty, dark gray to black growth on the underside of the leaf. You can have that without any foliar symptoms. So some of the plants I was seeing looked beautiful, except for this fuzz on the underside. You got to look under the leaves.
You got to look under their skirt. Yeah, boy, that's tough when you're out.
And then a yellowing will start happening, and often it's a banded kind of a yellowing,
mm-hmm.
in that the veins are preventing the pathogen from moving widely across the leaf, and you'll get a yellow band between the veins.
And, you know, when we talked about the late blight on tomatoes, the news was just worse, worse, worse. As soon as you noticed it and you were confirmed that these symptoms were late blight on your tomatoes, you were obligated as a home gardener to pull them up, put them in trash bags, sit them in the sun, and not spread the disease for the rest of the season.
Well, that is a good approach with any of these diseases that are as devastating as basil downy mildew and late blight. And that produce these spores that can move so easily.
Now, there's a lot of different kinds of basil. There's the, you know, the classic. Is it Genovese, the Italian large leaf basil?
That's the most popular, or sweet basil.
And then there's
sweet basil.
Then there's Thai basil, which is a very remarkably looking different plant, very ornamental plant. And then there's all sorts of specialty basils in the middle. Are we mostly talking about the classic sweet basil, the large leaf basil?
Yes, that and Greek. I've seen a lot of Greek on the market this year, and that's very susceptible.
So if people have to pull out their large leaf basil, which is, of course, the best for making pesto and the best for giving you lots of leaves for sauce, do you think it would be safe in the same garden if they could find plants to put in specialty basils?
You could. I mean, it's not the same use, but the spice types are definitely less susceptible. I'm working with a plant breeder at Rutgers who's trying to get the resistance out of the spice types and into a sweet basil. So hopefully we'll have a resistant variety at some point in the near future.
That is a great opportunity, because you and I know there's hundreds of different varieties of basil. So there should be a lot of genetics to tap into for resistance if they don't get it.
They're trying. Just takes time.
And I guess
it takes time to get a basil that's got the sweet basil characteristics you want, plus is resistant.
And this has nothing to do with your style of gardening, right? This is just if you get hit by a spore or you bought an infected plant.
Exactly.
One thing I tell people, obviously nobody's going to be crawling around their raised beds, but I say tape a mirror to the bottom of a hoe and use it to examine the undersides of your leaves, which is a great way to stop stink bugs early on, catch disease early on. If somebody sees, because especially with large leaf basil where the leaves, the lower leaves can touch the ground, if they see the beginnings of something that looks suspicious there and they very carefully pull them off and then maybe spread some compost around the plant, improve the air circulation, can they possibly save that plant, or is the clock ticking?
So the clock is ticking. One thing that's happening is as you move that leaf, you're probably going to disturb some spores. They're
right.
Going to move around. The other thing to realize is there's about 7-day period between infection and when you see symptoms.
Oh, okay.
So you got a bunch of leaves that look healthy that may not be. Interesting trick that I'm going to try this summer, it comes out of Israel, is having lights on at night. So if you're a creative gardener and you can set up a little light on your plant at night, it messes up the pathogen's ability to make spores.
Wow.
Another thing you could do is if your plants are in pots, is bring them in at night. Most of us, our houses has lower humidity than outside.
And put them in a brightly lit room if you have one at night.
You could do that. As long as the humidity is not hitting 85 at night, the pathogen can infect.
And basil is a very easy plant to grow in relatively small containers that would not be a chore to bring in during times of high humidity.
Not as a gardener. Certainly a commercial grower couldn't do that, but we gardeners could try it.
Thank you, Meg. Rarely do we get even a bite of good news. Generally, you're generally just warning us about what's going wrong in our garden. But this is a warning tempered with some interesting things to do. And you know what I'm going to remind myself to do next spring is people who go out and buy their starts, especially in big box stores, it is not that difficult to pick up the plant and look at the undersides of the leaves.
Absolutely. And keep an eye on it for about a week.
All right. Great advice, Meg. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. Dr. Meg McGrath, plant pathologist at Cornell and our go-to expert for all things bad that are happening to your plants. And it's not her fault. She's just the reporter, and an excellent reporter she is. Meg, thanks so much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, you are welcome. Anytime.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marianne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, hello, Marianne. How are you doing today?
Not too good today. I might melt. I'm not running around.
Yeah, summer is getting a little bit hot. Where are you, Mar?
I'm in a place called the English Village. It's between 21st and 22nd, between Walnut and Locust. It's a little historic courtyard.
But only a true Philadelphian would identify it that way. That was so perfect. I got thrown back to my childhood. We could almost talk about which streets go east and which ones go west in that neighborhood.
Of course.
Yeah. So what can we do for you, Mayor?
I had 26 rose bushes. I lived in Oak Lane, and I had a big garden and an old house. This is also an old house, but very little space for flowers, which I miss terribly. I love living in town,
right,
but I miss my garden.
Mm-hmm.
I had to argue with the Historic Commission to keep my roses. Several years ago, I had an issue with my neighbors because they said they couldn't walk through the pathway. But somewhere I figured out a clever way to put flower pots on wheels so that it wasn't permanent. And I still have my roses, but I have a problem from that.
Okay, and I just want to mention, you do leave them outside in the winter?
Oh, yes, all winter long.
But because you're in Center City, the roots don't freeze. You know, if you tried that out in the suburbs, they would not have survived this past winter.
Oh, not in my other house. Sure, it was open. But this is my problem. This past winter was very bad, and I lost 4 rose bushes.
Yeah, so I was right. Yeah, see,
yes.
It's very tough to have plants in containers over the winter. Now, I will tell you, 9 winters out of 10, you're going to get away with that in Center City. But last year was number 10, unfortunately.
Yes, it was, and I had a lot of losses. I also have a problem. The leaves have bites in them, and mm-hmm. I read somewhere that bees bite rose leaves.
I'll tell you right now, there is a species of ant called the leafcutter ant that
really?
Does that. And there is a species of bee, I believe, that is also called the leafcutter bee. And they're not eating them case. They're using those as, like, kind of building materials, as nesting materials.
Really?
Yes.
Is there anything I can do? They don't seem to kill the roses, but they look like hell.
Oh, okay. So describe what the leaves look like.
Like they have scoops of little bites out of the leaves.
Okay, because you haven't seen any bees or any ants with little pairs of scissors out there cutting away, right?
Not recently.
And those creatures make very clean cuts, by the way.
Yes, they do.
And is that what you're saying? You have
yes.
clean cuts?
Yes, I would say that it doesn't really look chewed up.
And the creatures don't go near the rosebuds?
No.
And,
no, they don't eat the rosebuds. No.
But they do eat a significant amount of the leaf material.
Yes, they eat a lot of it, yes.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you 2 questions that you're going to think are unrelated. These things are growing in pots. Do you feed them, and are they mulched with anything?
Okay, some are grown with pots that are outside the limit of the stereo of my neighbors.
Right.
The other ones are in a raised bed along the house.
Gotcha.
Both have the same problem, the ones in the pots and the ones that are in the raised bed of ground, which is raised about 2 feet.
Good. And do you feed them or mulch them?
I didn't mulch them this year. This is the first year that I didn't mulch them. If I had known it was going to be that cold, I would have done it.
Yeah, I really think that it was, I don't think mulch would have mattered. The snow cover acted as mulch. It was just too cold too long.
Yes.
Do you feed them?
Oh, absolutely. I use alfalfa, rose tone, Epsom salts, and...
Well, I can tell you right now you're overfeeding.
Well, I'm not doing lots of it, but I
right.
do a couple tablespoons Epsom salts. I read
right.
that.
A lot of rose growers do that, hoping it's going to increase the amount of blooms. Some tomato
yes,
growers
does
do
it
too. It may not. It's nothing I've ever used. It's technically a chemical, but it's a harmless chemical, so I don't really care
That's
about it.
That's what I figured. I don't use it too much.
Now,
the
rose tone...
The alfalfa meal once in a while.
Now, why are you using the alfalfa meal? That's a nitrogen fertilizer, and that's not going to help you get more roses.
Oh, you see, now a grower, one of the growers I bought from California told me that the alfalfa meal really makes the roses... healthy and really causes blooms, and it doesn't.
No, not in my experience, and we ain't.
Oh well, I won't buy that anymore because that's kind of hard to get.
Yes, it is. I'm surprised you were using it, and we ain't in California anymore, Dorothy.
I realize that, but I figured if it works there, maybe it'll work here.
Yeah. And the rose tone is a pretty natural granular
yes,
fertilizer.
It's natural. Yes.
Right. Okay, so I don't think you have leafcutter bees. They would be active during the day, and you would see them on the leaves.
Oh, I know. I don't see them.
Yeah, they wouldn't be doing their thing at night. And are you sure you don't have slugs?
Oh, I have slugs. I put out eggshells outside.
Now, that's not going to stop them. I'll tell you what. You have a beer in the house?
I can have beer in the house. That's
okay.
Not a problem.
In the evening, after the sun goes down, put some beer in little dishes and put it around the base of your roses.
Yes, I did that years ago. I'll have to do it again. All the roses in my other house, I had a lot of beer around.
Right. If you see dead drunken slugs in those dishes in the morning, there is a natural slug bait you can buy that's made with iron phosphate. It's all natural. It's a yeasty bait that has iron phosphate in it, and slugs can't metabolize it. It is so much safer than the old slug poisons used to be. It's totally non-toxic. It's sold under brand names like Sluggo and Escargo. And what you want to look is just go into any good garden center and tell them you need the slug bait that has iron in it.
Now, has iron?
Iron. I-R-O-N.
Okay, will iron do it?
Yes, but you got to get it in.
I have iron in a...
No.
No,
you got to go out and get this slug stuff because they have a bait that attracts them and then iron that kills them. I think it's slug damage.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes,
even the leaves are from slugs?
Absolutely.
And
they do their damage in the middle of the night when nobody sees them.
Thank you so much for your help, and I listen all the time.
Thank you. You take
Bye.
Care.
Bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind garlic growers that the only thing worse than harvesting your heads too early is harvesting them too late. So if the bottoms of your garlic plants have all turned brown, pull up a sample head. If it looks good, get them all out of the ground before those protective wrappers start to split apart. But don't go looking for all the details under the letter G for glorious garlic in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and a great resource to help schools stop spraying pesticides. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. If you have children in school and the schools might be spraying pesticides or herbicides around and you don't like that kind of thing, have we got a great resource for you, an IPM manual for schools that'll teach them everything they need to do to have a safe environment and avoid toxins. We'll tell you all the details after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Chuck, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Chuck. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
I am doing just fine, sir. And where is Chuck doing good?
He's doing good in Wilmington, Delaware.
Excellent. Excellent. What can we do for the Chuckster in Wilmington?
Well, I'm calling regarding my lawn. I have a modest-sized lawn. It's about maybe 1,000 square feet.
Right.
And I have a problem with expanding clover.
Right.
The lawn is maybe about 10 years old. I put it in as sod over a layer of about 6 inches of topsoil. And over those 10 years, I guess slowly some patches of clover have expanded, one of which is, I guess, about 10 feet long by about 4 or 5 feet at the moment.
So you're not getting little pieces of or plants of clover coming up in random spots. You actually have a clover section?
I have a couple of clover sections, maybe three.
I find that unusual. Clover is generally kind of a random occurring plant that's uniform throughout a lawn. Now, you say you installed it as sod, which tends to work very well. Do you feed it?
I do put corn gluten meal on it in the spring.
Okay.
I did this spring as well.
And do you do anything in the fall?
No.
Oh, okay. Good, good. You're not going to be difficult at all. But I'm curious about the fact that the clover is clustering. You don't have any kind of in-ground irrigation system.
No, nope, not.
Is it possible that the clover is in an area that stays wetter than the rest of the lawn?
Well, I could say that in one spot, but another spot, it's one of the drier spots in the very center of the lawn.
Okay.
Yeah, that theory might be a little difficult here.
Okay, so clover is a sign of two things. Clover is a sign of a lawn that is underfed and overwatered. Now, unfortunately, everybody's lawns have been overwatered this spring and early summer because it's just been constantly raining in most areas around the Philadelphia area. So everybody's a little wet. And clover is an interesting response to underfeeding. Now, when you cut your own lawn, a lawn that small, right?
Right, yes.
And what do you cut it with?
I have an electric lawnmower.
Oh, excellent.
It's a 3-inch high.
Good, good, good. And you leave the clippings on the lawn?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Because clover is a classic sign that clippings are being collected. Clover is a nitrogen-fixing legume. If you want to pull up a couple of the individual plants, especially at the end of the season, you'll see little nodules down on their roots. And these are the symbiotic bacteria that allow the plant to actually take nitrogen out of the air and convert it to plant food. And a lot of people feel that when a lawn isn't getting enough nutrition, it kind of creates this desire and lets clover come in, and then the clover prospers and the lawn gets fed. So, you know, in one sense, clover is not a problem in that every time you cut a lawn with clover on it, you're feeding your lawn more than just the regular lawn clippings. Of course, native bees, and if there's any honeybees in your areas, they love coming to clover. And, you know, one of the crazy things is everybody is so obsessed with having a uniform lawn now. But up until the 1960s, clover was included in every lawn seed mixture because it would naturally feed the lawn and people like the flowers.
It seems to be expanding.
And yeah.
That's a concern I have mostly about it.
And it's mostly because you're doing one feeding in the spring that's a light feeding that's also preventing crabgrass, but you're not feeding your lawn in the fall, which is the more important time for the grass.
Okay.
The natural pre-herbicide effect of corn gluten meal applied at the very end of summer, just as the last heat wave breaks, prevents more clover from germinating. That's when most of the clover actually germinates.
Okay,
so
very good.
Put it down as soon as the summer heat is waning, you know, sometime from mid to late August. Don't delay. If you want to stop these cool season weeds that germinate, dandelion as well, clover, a whole bunch of different weeds, you feed around mid-August, just as the last 90-degree day is passing.
Okay, very good.
Just let the corn gluten meal do its job, see how the lawn fills in, and then if you want to reseed, do that next fall.
Great. All right. Well, we're very good. I appreciate it, Mike.
All right, Chuck.
Okay. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Melody, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Mel. Where are you?
I'm in Upper Southampton, PA.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you?
Well, at the start of spring, I thought I would save up on seeding soil and buy some leaf compost to start my seeds in for a small CSA startup.
Okay.
But it turned out to be leaf mulch instead.
Right.
So so I'm wondering how I can make turn the leaf mulch into leaf compost for next year's seeding mix.
And this is this may seem like a foolish question, but I hear what sounds like birds in the background.
Yeah, it is, actually.
Are you outside?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. So you there's like birds in the trees singing a song.
Yeah, I guess there are.
How appropriate for this show. So you bought what you thought was going to be compost made from fall leaves. It turned out to be shredded leaves that were still mostly shredded leaves.
Right, that's right. It's all black and stuff, and it has good smell, but it's still mulch because I put a bunch of seeds in there, and they all were kind of stunted. They didn't grow at all.
Right. I would never even attempt to use pure compost as a seed starting mixture.
Okay.
I know it sometimes seems expensive to go out and buy a bag of seed starting mix or potting soil, but I've been starting my own seeds inside for over 30 years, and early on I used to try to cheat and use garden soil or compost or stuff like this. One year I even read you should use your own soil, but you should sterilize it first. So I put it on a baking tray in our oven at home.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, I thought my wife was going to leave me. I thought we were going to have to buy a new range. Oh, the windows were open for a week, and it still smelled terrible. So it's really worth it to use the professional six packs, you know, that the nurseries use, and to buy a bag of seed starting mix. In fact, I take seed starting mix, you know, which is already really light. I tell people when they're going to start seeds, they should buy the lightest bag in the store because the roots really like that. And then what I'll do is I have a big bag of perlite at home, the little white particles, and I'll mix even more perlite into the seed starting mix to lighten that up even further. And the lighter the mix, the better my transplants look. That's when you get those nice, short, stocky transplants with a good root system. Now, how much leaf mulch did you buy?
It's a truckload.
Excellent, excellent. And is it just piled up somewhere?
Yeah, it's just piled up somewhere, and there's tarp over it. There are mushrooms growing from there.
Okay. Yeah, so first thing is get rid of the tarp.
Okay.
You never want to cover shredded leaves or compost like that. You want to expose it to the air. That's why you're getting those mushrooms. So get that tarp off of it. And, and you say you have a garden somewhere?
Yes, I do. It's right next to it.
Oh, okay. Well, you have two choices. Either you can mulch your garden, you know, just move the shredded leaves around a little bit. Don't use the top and the sides. And I bet if you go 6 inches to a foot into that pile, it's going to be finished compost.
And then
you can simply put that on top of your garden in between your plants right now. That's the best mid-season feeding you can give vegetable plants is an inch of compost. And if you dig into it and the center is still mostly shredded leaves, don't worry about it. Put it right on the garden as a mulch in between your plants. That's what a lot of my compost didn't finish up over the winter. And so we just applied it as a mulch on top of the garden, and the garden is doing sensationally. And then just leave that pile of shredded leaves and compost open to the air, and within another month, it'll certainly be all composted, and then you can either you know, protect it, or I would just spread it on the garden, even in the fall.
Right. All right. Even tomatoes?
Yes, especially tomatoes.
Okay. Especially. All right.
Because the especially the most finished part of the pile around your tomatoes, and then the stuff that's still shredded leaves around peppers and cucumbers and stuff.
All right. Okay. I will try that.
And those birds in the background are so fabulous. It's amazing. Now I feel like we should be recording the show under a tree somewhere with birds in the background.
Yeah.
All right, Melody. I think your big pile is going to be just fine no matter how you use it. And just don't throw any tarps over them anymore.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much, Mike.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for a very important question of the week. How should schools deal with weeds? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's question.
Sure, Mike. Miriam in Narberth, PA writes, I'm a parent with children in the Lower Merion School District, which uses Roundup as part of its weed control program. I was upset to learn this, given the increasing evidence that Roundup may contribute to a host of chronic illnesses. So I and other concerned parents met with the district's IPM coordinator, who asked us to offer alternatives to Roundup. I suggested flame weeders, and he responded that the district is not allowed to use anything with an open flame. Do you have any other suggestions? Mike, something sounds a little fishy here.
Right, like a, quote, IPM coordinator who's reportedly asking parents for alternatives that he should be trained to offer. Now, at its best, IPM, Integrated Pest Management, is a system that controls every type of pest, insects, vermin, weeds, without using anything toxic. But the term has also been terribly misused by people who want to seem progressive, but who think of chemical sprays as the first rather than the last resort. A fellow gardener once described the attitude of the worst offenders as, well, we released a couple of ladybugs and that didn't work, so we soaked everything with malathion.
And what about Miriam mentioning how the district is not allowed to use anything with an open flame?
That's a bummer. I guess the poor kids in science class don't have Bunsen burners. Anyway, this may be a misunderstanding of a rule, an overreaction to something like a restriction on burning trash, or an actual regulation that simply needs to be addressed. But it could also just be stubbornness. Unfortunately, many groundskeepers have always just sprayed poison at problems, and it'll take two things to change their mindset. One is training and education. You can't just take away their Roundup and tell them to figure out the rest on their own.
Right, education. What's the second thing?
Well, to quote an old joke, the light bulb must be willing to change. You can show those groundskeepers how other methods work, but they have to buy into them for the alternatives to be used successfully. Anyway, if people are going to insist on a direct approach to weeds, there are herbicidal soaps, high-strength vinegars, and broadleaf weed killers whose active ingredients are iron, cedar oil, or concentrated essence of orange peels, in addition to the flame weeders that are standard issue in many school districts. And of course, there's mostly prevention, like proper lawn care to keep weeds from appearing in the first place. So I emailed Miriam back to assure her that non-chemical weed control is pretty easy, explaining that my local township has never sprayed. They control all the roadside weeds and such mechanically. So here's the return email we got from her.
Miriam writes, thanks so much for getting back to me. I should have been more specific. They claim that only Roundup can kill particularly noxious weeds. Do you have any suggestions regarding poison ivy, poison sumac, invasive ground ivy, and Phragmites? Wait a minute, Phragmites? Isn't that the giant reed of the wetlands we discussed on the show a couple years back?
Yeah, apparently they have much bigger problems than herbicides. At least one of their schools seems to be built on a swamp. And Roundup is federally prohibited in the kind of wet areas where Phragmites even grows. But it's the poison ivy in there that really got my attention. And it's one of the big reasons I picked this email for this time of year, as we need to remind people that herbicides may kill the poison ivy plant, but they don't affect the allergenic oil. Spraying herbicides actually makes poison ivy more dangerous. People think the dead plant is safe, but it can still give kids a really bad poison ivy rash.
And exposure to an herbicide.
Right, so with poison ivy, you should never burn or spray. Just cut to the chase and manually remove the plant while wearing the proper protection. Otherwise, you've got dead but still dangerous plants around.
And this school district is in the greater Philadelphia area, so they could ask one of the leading experts on this weed, Umar Micah, the renowned poison ivy horticulturalist, to come out and give them a lesson on safe removal. He's local.
And, you know, Umar could do the same for districts in other areas, either via traveling there or a video hookup. All that's required for this to become the new norm is for parents to get involved. Years ago, when our kids came home with a notice that the school grounds were going to be sprayed with 6 different herbicides, I immediately went to see the principal, and she just had the groundskeepers change tactics right away.
Did you have to tell them what to use instead?
No, I just had them contact our friends at the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California, and request a copy of a very important publication they produced for the EPA. It's called IPM for Schools, a how-to manual. It's a big 3-ring binder with 19 different sections detailing alternative treatments for everything from ants, head lice, and spiders to lawn care and, yes, weed control. School districts can buy a hard copy for $50, or they can read the entire thing online for free.
At BIRC.org.
Well, that sure was an interesting look at how to help parents get local schools off the toxic treadmill, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail and access the BIRC's manual on IPM for schools, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to integrate my pests if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And if you do send us that email,
please, please, please tell us where you live. That's your location, not the house. Please tell us where in the country. Thank you.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant is Trisha Whiting. Our hired hand is Matt Hudecki. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and luckily I got learned real good when I was in school, so I know to get back here in time to see you again next week. When is thistle a good thing? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, a listener reminds us of the value of locally available materials, plus how almost anything can become a container, and your fabulous phone calls.